Okay. Still coming so in okay.
Give us a couple bars of your favorite song.
From the Halls of Montezuma.
Yeah, okay. You're coming in better than you have all day.
It good?
Yeah.
You good?
Sounds good.
Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
Rich.
And Kyle.
Rich and I are U.S. Marines, and the opinions expressed on the cast are our own, not official military policy.
Any of the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, no special guest, just the love between the hosts.
And we got a lot to cover.
We do. We have three articles that we're going to chat through, and then we'll get into a lightning round of holiday fun to recap the year. And then we'll get into our glowing pontification time. It will be lovely.
All right. I have to start off the podcast, everybody, by asking John, Rich, how is the overall health and welfare of your families 1 week out from the holiday break? Because my entire household is sick. I've lost my voice. I'm coming in soft and NPR gravelly on this episode.
Yeah. So I'll lead this one off. I am, if there was wood, I would knock. Here we go. Yeah. Thank God for those going away gifts. So far, the family is healthy. Although, dear listeners, we barely got this recorded because of the general health of everybody going around. So far, Shriner family is holding it down.
I'm super proud of you guys. Like, just way to rock it.
Yeah. So, guys, from my side of the house, I'm on leave. I'm in Ohio. There's a lot of hand moving going on, which our fellow cast members can't see out there. However, everybody's healthy, super excited to be here. I got my little drink on the rocks and I am ready to rock. So let's roll.
All right.
Okay. So I'll kick things off. So our first article is a BBC article. And again, like always, you'll have those in the show notes. So one of Ukraine's three major cell providers, their biggest one, Kyivstar, was taken out by a suspected cyber attack, which is being loosely, although very obviously attributed to Russia.
It's real questionable who launched that attack. Real questionable.
We're really not sure who, but maybe somebody, possibly Russia. So having said that, I thought it was kind of novel just to think through a couple things. One, they know in Ukraine that people are going to attack their infrastructure. They've experienced it already, and they've built a robust setup so that each of the three providers have interoperability and all that kind of stuff. So if one's taken down, the others pick up. But this outage affected 24 million mobile users. And anybody who's ever been a combo before knows there's what your diagram says is going to go down and then what actually goes down. And so a couple of things that went down that were or were not a surprise to the infrastructure owners, air raids, so the air raid sirens for incoming missiles stopped working when the cellular network went down, and ATMs stopped processing transactions when cells went down. So I would love a first hot take on what do y'all think of this? And then second, what do you think would go down in the U.S. if AT&T stopped working?
I mean, I don't know why anyone's using such a terrible internet provider, but whatever. My initial take is that this is, and you know, I don't have my finger deeply on the pulse of this, but this is the first successful cyber attack that I've kind of heard of in Ukraine since the start of this invasion. I mean, there were some attempts early on and a lot of mitigation strategy, but this is the first one that I think has made the news under like success and major outage and caused disruption, which is kind of phenomenal from my perspective when you think about it, of how little cyber activity we're generally seeing have an actual impact on the battlefield or have an actual impact on the population in the Ukraine. That'd be my first one. And also, yeah, there's so much that relies upon the internet, relies upon cell signals that we don't think about. So I think that if the average person lost the use of their cell phone and their home internet, that we are like three cold meals away from absolute societal anarchy. I don't know, measure that however you want, but that's my take.
And you think we'd make it through three?
I think three cold meals. Yeah. Like if you lost internet right now, I think by tomorrow evening, you'd have people, you know, riding bicycles down the street, holding torches.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to jump in here real quick and just ask the question. Do we think commercial internet is critical infrastructure? Drop mic. Question to you guys.
I mean, if you're defending your home territory, I think commercial infrastructure is absolutely mission critical. Absolutely. Like no argument whatsoever. If you are the aggressor or you're doing some sort of like forward defensive operations, maybe not at all. But no, I mean, if you're talking about defending sovereign territory, it's absolutely.
And Rich, I think in the 90s mindset was wired is critical. And if you're willing to go wireless, this is not really a critical network. I think we have leaped way past that at this point to where there are critical wireless networks. And I think I would, you know, I don't know if legally I could defend this, but I think I would definitely say wireless, specifically cellular, is critical infrastructure.
Yeah. And I think too, just to bring this up, right, is I'm pretty sure the average American looks at wireless or wired internet services, commercial internet services, I'll just call it that, right? Like electricity, right? We pay a utility bill for it. You know, right now, if you're in Europe, you're having a hard time figuring out how you're going to heat your home, especially if you're in Eastern Europe, right? Like between all the disruptions in power and energy coming out of Russia, China's jumping into that game to kind of bring it into the geopolitics, you know, realm for a second. So I think people do in the States look at commercial internet service as a basic utility. And yeah, I would agree with you guys. I think it'd be a pretty big deal if this stuff went down, like alternate communications networks and things of that nature would be a big issue for the U.S. if we had a situation like that happen in the States.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think even with everything around net neutrality, I think that most lawmakers would also agree with you that the internet is a basic utility service.
And for our next article, this is actually a podcast, and I have talked about this on the cast before, Packet Pushers. They have a specific podcast.
Very cool,
that's called, yeah, thank you. That's called Heavy Strategy. I really enjoy this, and the two hosts basically argue with each other the entire time. And for this podcast, they were talking specifically about power for data centers. And while I would love to talk about this, I feel like it would be stealing Rich's soul because this is like – his thing. So Rich, over to you.
Thanks, John. Yeah, well, I am super passionate about data centers and processing data. I think we talked about that on the cast a bunch. But yeah, let's jump right into this. So as John mentioned, Packet Pushers, amazing podcast. And they're talking about in this specific podcast, which we'll have a link to in the show notes, about powering data centers and it being a massive deal in the current decade, which, I mean, kind of leaps right from the conversation we had about utilities and power and generating heat in Eastern Europe being an issue. So in this case, what they're talking about on the podcast is massive increases in the consumption and scaling of off-prem clouds, right? Has exceeded the capacity of like civilian power grids when cloud operators are reluctant to sign, you know, 30-year supply agreements so that more power plants can be built. And what I thought was like super cool about this podcast was at a time when, you know, we'll probably talk about this later in the cast, where you see the advent of artificial intelligence, or what Kyle would say is machine learning, and, you know, the maturation thereof, you really need data centers powered at scale to do this data processing across the board. And so I think the coolest thing about this article is they start to talk about just the amount of wattage required to run a cloud data center. So they throw a number out there. They say generally measured in megawatts, right? It's how they would scale this. The best that the authors can tell of the podcast is they're talking about the 50 to 100 megawatt range to just run a data center. So not, you know, the Back to the Future gigawatts range, but pretty close. And they also talk about different places on the globe, but specifically kind of focus about on North America, talking about Northern Virginia and, you know, how many data centers are in the tri-state area, so on and so forth. But without just going into like the raw, you know, megawatt usage, the coolest thing about the article is, as I mentioned earlier, with the scaling up of all this compute that machine learning is processing to support like artificial intelligence services, they really start to get in the meat and potatoes of, look, If we truly want to invest in these emerging technologies, we're going to have to continue to build data centers at a time on the globe where energy consumption is a really big deal. And so to John's point earlier about me being passionate about this, this year I got to like kind of do a deep dive on emerging tech and what different parts of the globe, different parts of emerging tech were kind of being invested in. And one of the areas that if you look at it from like a Western society perspective is in sub-Saharan Africa in the Africa Data Centers Project, where you know the Western countries are looking to invest in the development of sub-Saharan African or global Southern Hemisphere countries, developing countries. And one thing they're trying to do is build data centers in this corridor that they call the Libido Corridor, which kind of runs from the sea inland into central sub-Saharan Africa. So my point in mentioning all this is that data centers and jobs inside of data centers are going to be a real economic force to generate jobs for folks in countries that are developing and looking for these new kind of high tech, but kind of like lower skilled areas that you could really get people some good training, some good jobs for income from. But the bottom line here is it's going to sap a ton of energy from the global ecosystem where we don't have a lot of it to go around in abundance. And as a corollary to that, you know, and Kyle and John, you may want to talk about this a little more, but you know, data centers also have to be cooled. They also have to be environmentally, you know, controlled in a way that allows the services to run for the customers and the consumers of those services. And one of the things that's super interesting here is going into an area like sub-Saharan Africa and investing in data centers is great from an economic perspective. But if you're in an area where you have like literally people going to get water every day, like in the past, humans used to forage for, you know, food. People are doing that right now for water in these areas. And data centers and building of like semiconductors takes a lot of refined water. And so I just think we're at this point in kind of technology evolution and plus looking at different human societies moving forward, you know, into 2024 and beyond, that we're really going to have to grapple with this issue globally. So guys, ranted a ton there about energy usage. I thought the Packet Pushers podcast was amazing, but just want to get your thoughts too. Like, is Rich just way overly passionate about this? Or do you see kind of this confluence of ideas coming together where you have data centers and natural resources? And we probably got to think about this thing from a global perspective.
Yeah, no, you brought up a ton of good points there, Rich. I'm going to riff a little bit on all of them. And, you know, we can't really talk about this unless we give some context of scale. So the podcast talks a little bit about this again, and a lot of it about this if you listen to the podcast more regularly. But to give an example, the city of New York, like Island of Manhattan, uses about 11,000, zeros are important, people, 11,000 megawatts of power in an average day. The largest data centers in Virginia, which is what they talk about in this article quite a bit, is Facebook's with 562 megawatts of contracted power daily. And then Amazon and Microsoft and T-Mobile and Apple kind of come in 3, 4, 5, 6 on that list. So you're talking about, from their top seven, about 2,000 megawatts a day. So let's just go ahead and round a bit and play with some numbers and say 1/5 of the island of Manhattan's power consumption is being used for Virginia's top six data center users. And then, Rich, you talked about the environmentals that go into that. Because just because you can power a computer or many, many hundreds of thousands of computers, those things produce a metric ton of heat. And cooling data centers becomes incredibly difficult. I can only speak from Google's perspective, from data center understanding, because those are the ones that I've been around and been involved with in some way, shape, or form. But Google specifically chooses its data centers and puts them in places where cooling is prioritized. Power is generally cheap to get if you contract it, and you can do that in advance. And there's negotiations, but it's incredibly hard to cool things like in a giant desert or in a place that has a very humid environment. So, for example, Google's built some data centers like right next to large lakes and hydroelectric facilities where they can use the water to cool facilities, or in ways where they can take outside air and actually build the data center around making a giant convection tower where the hot air blows out the middle and they suck in cold air from the sides and things like that. And you can get really inventive with this and uses of good renewable materials and stuff like that. But the crux of this from an environmental perspective is that cooling is tough and it requires a lot of innovative design and sometimes a lot of air conditioners and other things that produce a lot of toxic chemicals in the world. And then back to the power perspective, if you're using 1/5 of the island of Manhattan's power consumption for a bunch of computers and there is a power outage, you can't just flip the switch on that and let it all go down. You need tons and tons and tons of backup generators. The Facebook facility that we were talking about here with 562 megawatts needs 105 backup diesel generators. And those are not like the ones that you have next to your house. These are gigantic black cloud spewing diesel generators. They're like the mega generators that you would see that are super loud, that do all those things. And each of those produces a ton of toxic chemicals when they run. Now, obviously, those are ideally not going to run that often. So maybe the impact of this is actually fairly minimal. And I'm not trying to get into the greenhouse gas emissions or climate change debate at this point in time. But just to say that the environmental impact of building these giant data centers is high. Is it higher than a bunch of people running their servers locally or a bunch of servers in a closet in your business? Very, very arguable. But that just, there's so much nuance to running data centers. I think that to your skill point, Rich, being, you know, I work in a data center is going to, it already is, but a lot of people mistake this, is that's not a ultra high tech job. What that is a extremely valuable trade, just like electrician, plumber, you know, a construction worker, anything like that. It's critical to society at this point, and it, you know, needs unionization and all these other things to protect those workers, but it is an absolute critical requirement for a trade environment and for that infrastructure.
Yeah. And Kyle, I just want to mention too, because we talked about, I think it might have been on the last cast, John, where we talked about, you know, IBM producing better, you know, not just IBM, but other semiconductor producers, like making chips that are way more energy efficient, right? For a host of different reasons. But, you know, even the manufacturers of the components that get installed in these data centers at that level, at the semiconductor level, are looking to conserve energy by putting, you know, in the past, you used to have memory modules that resided on the other side of a motherboard from where the CPU or the processor was, right? And so there was time and energy spent transferring data back and forth. Now we're starting to see, and we're not even talking about like the 5 or 7 nanometer level advanced state-of-the-art chips. Like we're talking about 12 nanometer chips, right? That literally were taking memory modules and sticking them on the chip interface so that the energy efficiency is so much more, you know, I'll just say efficient, to use the word again, that we're even saving energy and cost consumption at the chip level. So to Kyle's point, when you magnify that, and not just a data center, but multiple data centers in like a geographic region, like, you know, Northern Virginia, we're talking about significant energy consumption. And I just think it's, you know, and I promise I'll stop after this comment, but it's just such an amazing time to be alive right now from a technology perspective, as we're watching the world grapple with, there's some basic human necessities that need to be met in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like to Kyle's point about skilled jobs and getting people where they need to be economically to live lives that, you know, are pleasurable for people and not hard. But then you also have this like immense demand for state-of-the-art technology, which hopefully through data processing gets us better at figuring out really, really hard problems to solve, like human health problems or global, you know, environmental problems. So I just think it's a really important juxtaposition to kind of take a look at, champagne word, I know, crowd, from a Marine. But it's really important, I think, to kind of grapple with this as technologists, right? But also just as global citizens. So again, promise I would stop. Want to get into the fun or holiday stuff, but super cool podcast, John. Thanks for tossing that our way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll end on two comments. So Kyle mentioned for data centers, powers and cloud especially, power's pretty cheap. And then he went into the other things, which I don't disagree with any of the other things. But what the podcast basically said was, it's cheap until a tipping point, which we are rapidly reaching, and then things about to get expensive.
Yeah, like the supply-demand curve is something I totally glossed over, and thanks for calling that out.
Yep, no worries. And then the other thing worth mentioning is every search now has, for me, has a, hey, would you like AI to gen up some stuff for you too? And remember, at least today's paradigm, AI, GPUs, very power intensive per query, give or take, yada, yada. That demand is not going away. And so I'm kind of thinking like, ooh, this podcast definitely got my brain moving. So I hope it does the same for you. So kind of in that realm, though, we covered several months ago an article from a very famous person in the cloud space talking about getting out of cloud and moving on-prem. And there was an update to this. So Kyle, since you were the you were the biggest response the first time we brought this up. So I'm just going to toss that grenade down the hallway and see if you jump on it.
Of course, John, you're going to tee me up to talk more about DHH. One of my least favorite people to talk about, but here we go. All right. So bringing everybody back up to speed, David Heinemeier Hansson, I may have butchered his middle name there a little bit, commonly referred to as DHH, the guy that founded 37 Signals, Basecamp, Hey, the email service, and also claims to have invented Ruby on Rails, which is somewhat attributable, is a very polarizing figure in the IT world and in the development world and the programming world, especially in the cloud world, because he seems to have a unique hatred of cloud technology. But I'll say this, he does it with a convincing argument that his company doesn't need cloud. And I would say that DHH is probably right, that his company doesn't need cloud. But I want to be very clear with everybody that your company is probably very unlike DHH's company. Now, to super TLDR, and we've got the link to his post, which he announced yesterday, December 19th, 2023, where he talks about how they have officially exited the cloud. So his entire company, which he calls Hey.com, is the sort of umbrella for all of the companies that he runs now, have exited the cloud completely. They bought $600,000 worth of Dell servers to exit their company. So he self-describes this as saying he needed 4,000 vCPUs, 7.8 terabytes of RAM, and 384 terabytes of NVMe storage is what he needed to exit the cloud completely, which is awesome. I will just do my counter argument here. If you can't tell by my tone, I generally disagree with this article as being good advice for anybody. So just take this completely with the grain of salt that it deserves and the level of scrutiny that you need.
And real quick, the reason we are talking is because you might be sitting at home and be like, okay, if I'm in the military, why do I care about this? This is something that's blowing up on LinkedIn, and you're going to get questions, or people are going to ask you to react to, hey, there are some people who are doing this at big scale who are saying cloud is not the right answer. So Kyle's going to go into, hey, is this right for commercial? Is it right for military? And give you a chance to kind of think through an alternate perspective here.
That's right. So when we talk about the value of the cloud, the ability to develop quickly and scale quickly are kind of like one and two on that list, right? If you have a steady state, predictable workload that is not changing that often, then cloud might not be the answer for you. Seriously. Like, I have helped plenty of customers here in Colorado in the oil and gas segment who have servers in a closet that have been running since like 2012. And I promise you, that is the cheapest option. There's just no escaping that, right? You don't need a support contract for that because they've already end of life and expired. If those things are still running and you're still running like VMware 3 or whatever on it, cool. Rock that CASBAH if it's serving the needs of your business. And DHH's companies provide pretty consistent offerings. It's like a managed email client and a managed product management suite. So this is SaaS at its heart, right? And it's SaaS that doesn't have a lot of infrastructure-based innovation. So this is what it's all about. If you are just running, I'm going to go back in time, all you military listeners. If you're just running NMCI, right? And you know exactly what it's going to take to run NMCI, to run email and your help desk, that probably doesn't need to be on cloud. Fixed capacity runs well on fixed hardware. This is not rocket surgery, everybody, but just know what you need to do. If you need to fire up domains on demand and entire battle spaces on demand, or rapidly iterate on new product ideas that will have a variety of infrastructure requirements, that's very expensive because you buy once, cry once, and then it sits there whether you use it or not, as opposed to paying by the minute or by the vCPU hour on cloud. If we're talking about 4,000 vCPUs, you know, just under 8 terabytes of RAM and 384 terabytes of SSD-based, NVMe-based storage, that is not a trivial amount of infrastructure to be running in an on-demand model in the cloud. That would be far more, if you want my honest opinion, than $600,000 worth of Dell servers. That sounds like he got a steal on that infrastructure. And I bet Dell was happy to bend over backwards to help them out with providing that low-cost quote to get him to post their name in this article. So,
wait a minute. Are you telling me a hardware provider would be willing to help?
Integrated vertical marketing. You know, it's a whole thing. I don't know that anybody off the street is going to go with that vCPU terabyte NVMe account, and Dell's going to quote you $600,000, by the way, everybody. I have a sneaking suspicion there's just a few points being shaved off the top by Dell's marketing team for this article. But just, again, you got to know the tech needs for your company. Cloud is absolutely not the answer to everything, right? But if you are a startup, if you need elasticity, if you need the ability to develop quickly, and you've got a dynamic, variable skill base that you can work with, cloud is pretty freaking great. And I think it is the answer to a lot of technical problems in the IT space. A lot, not all, right? If you run a SaaS company that has offered the same sorts of things that are almost commoditized in this world, and you have an extremely loyal staff who have been doing it for years, and you've set it up correctly to where software is your big abstraction layer, and your team is incredibly good at software. And oh, by the way, the CTO of the company, DHH, literally has a right to claim they invented Ruby on Rails. I think you've got some pretty darn good software developers who might know how to develop really good, efficient software. Did I describe the average military unit just now? Absolutely not. Did I describe the average SOC, NOC, McNOSC operating center right now? I absolutely did not. You need to know your Marines, right? And employ them in accordance with their capabilities. I know I just butchered the leadership trait there, but like,
you need to, spot on.
Yeah, you need to fight the war you're equipped to fight. And this is not something that I want anybody in the DoD reading and going, you know, we should rethink this Jedi contract thing. Like, stop doing that. And think critically about what you need. The answer is not all cloud. And the answer is not all on-prem. The answer is a nuanced and gray area in the middle. And I may have just fired off my hot take early, but there it is. You just zoom back on that. I'm going on mute. It's over to you, John.
I'm going to jump in before John does.
Fine. You jump in.
I can't help myself. Cal's my hero. But I do want to bring this back to warfighting for a second, because I have a sticker that's actually on the top of my computer that says warfighting, because we're warfighters and technologists. So I just want to bring this home one more time, but in a more military fashion, right? In a day and age where the previous commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, and the current commandant are working to gain capability, to gain an asymmetric advantage over adversaries to support national security. One of the things I can guarantee we're probably not going to do in the Marine Corps is find some 10,000-hour coders that invented Ruby on Rails and employ them to make all the things better from a hardware perspective, right? And so I just want to say this very clearly, right? We need warfighters to fight wars and team with technology professionals to use that tech to gain an asymmetric advantage. And one of the ways we're going to do that is by leveraging off-prem cloud services in a secure way. So,
and Rich, I got to, before you can even breathe, I need to yes and you and say, yes, and we are not going to get it right the first time, which I think Kyle actually hit with his most salient point right in the beginning, which is like, if you know exactly, and like, just stop right there. We do not know exactly. We are yes. going to need to iterate. We are going to try and fail and try and fail and try and fail. And the Marines are amazing at this. We are not going to go in with a 3,000 page fixed exactly what we need contract. We are going to learn, adapt. And, you know, the one word for this is iterate. And that is why we definitely do not want to just buy a bunch of hardware and say, ah, well, there was a pretty cool LinkedIn post, so let's just not do this.
Yeah. And I think too, one thing to mention, I know, so we're all cloud practitioners, right? On the cast. So one of the things, and like you said, Kyle, like I don't want to go too far to the right, like jumping on the article, because you're right. Like organizations assess what they need from a resourcing perspective, and then they resource appropriately, right? The good ones do. So I guess my point is right now, I honestly, with all fiber of my being, believe that public-private partnerships between technologists on the private side and technologists on the public side, and then the warfighters that they're enabling, that is truly a recipe for success. So it's not really about just cloud, although this article talks about cloud. This is like how to leverage tech to do national security. If national security is, you know, a verb in this case, we need to do national security, and we're going to need the best and brightest that our country can offer to enable our warfighters. So I'll shut up there, John, because we're probably bleeding too much into other parts.
And I'll say this, the best and brightest that our country can offer should not be working on VMs, right? They should not be working on setting up basic load balancers. Like, we're past that, right? If this was 15 years ago, maybe that would be super cutting edge, right? If people were still trying to figure out what EC2 and S3 meant, then maybe we'd be needing to do that. But I hate to say this, but it's commoditized, right? It's absolutely commoditized. If you look at the service breakdown in the screenshots from this blog post, it's like the most expensive things they were spending money on is OpenSearch, relational databases, and EC2 instances and EC2 network traffic. I'm like, those are the most core pieces of any infrastructure. So, like, again, you got to know what you need. And I love what you both are saying. Like, use the right people to partner in the right ways to take the very finite and outstanding resources available to the Marine Corps and put them on the toughest problems for the Marine Corps.
Okay, we're going to make a hard stop here, and it's holiday cast time. And we're going year in review, and we are going to start this off with a lightning round.
Well, so John, we're going to do this? We're going to do this.
The rules of the lightning round, Kyle, former Chief Warrant Officer, you will abide by the rules for one time.
That doesn't sound like me at all.
You're gonna give me this, okay? So we are going into the fun lightning round. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. Try to keep your answers to about a sentence or two. And then
10 words?
No follow-ups. You just, no, not that many.
10 words?
Too many.
Okay. Too many words.
No,
10 words?
One or two sentences. And then we're going to get through the lightning round, and then we can go into pontificating. So go. Lightning round time.
I'm ready.
First, what was the least surprising thing you read in the news this year? We'll start with Kyle. We'll go alphabetically.
That so many people got hacked and everyone's shocked.
Okay, fair. Rich.
That API keys are just passwords masquerading.
Okay, and I am going to go with Okta said that only a little bit was breached, and it turned out there was not just a little bit breached.
Shocking. I'm shocked.
Okay, so what was the most surprising thing you read in the news, Kyle?
The most surprising thing that I read in the news this year is that someone in the federal government truly understood what happened in the SolarWinds breach and took the appropriate actions to say, this is not okay. I was shocked by that actually came out and was so well written.
Yeah, I'll pick up here. The most surprising thing I read was that the U.S. actually put economic sanctions on companies producing semiconductors that were being shipped to, you know, I'll call them competitors or adversaries. Like, I never thought, one, the U.S. government could spell semiconductor, two, that it would take an economic action that wasn't something more than like a verbal version of a sanction. Like, guys, the government actually is trying to curtail where these things go. So surprising to me.
Okay. And I'm going to somewhat steal Kyle's and say a CTO is being held accountable, possibly being held accountable.
Yeah. I mean, that's super shocking. Yeah.
Okay. Next, the most disappointing thing that you read or thing that happened.
Oh, this is like Sophie's Choice is the worst. Most disappointing.
Most disappointing thing.
I think you've made me talk about DHH three times on this podcast this year. That's what's disappointing to me. Is that a cop-out answer? I don't know.
No, I don't think so. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, from my perspective, Jen, I think the most disappointing thing that I've read this year was really the whole initial fail of the Jedi contract because of litigation just hurt my soul. Like, I know it's back and it's rebranded as the Joint Warfighting Cloud Capability. I kind of like Jedi. I think a whole bunch of people in our generation like it because there's just a Star Wars tie to it. It seems cool. Kind of like Reagan's, you know, Star Wars thing. But I thought it was really sad to kind of watch that litigation go down and then a rebranding happening. And then the government kind of saying, okay, we figured this out. Now let's really partner with the private industry. So that was my disappointing moment of the year.
Yeah, that one's actually really good. I think, and this is recent and maybe I could be missing it, but I believe VMware is doing away with its whole, you buy the license and you have it for the life cycle setup. So we're moving to a kind of like a consumption model for even on-prem stuff. That's disappointing.
Wow. I had not heard that, but now I'm going to go research it.
I could be wrong, but if that is true, I'm going to make that my most disappointing. Okay. So real quick in the lightning round, we are fast forwarding to December of 2024.
And time machine?
Time machine.
It's a hot tub time machine. Let's go.
You're doing it. We're hot tub time machining. In a year from now, what do you think the least surprising thing you will read in the news would be?
A year from now, the least surprising thing that I'm going to read in the news is that some groundbreaking article that came out was actually just an AI hallucinogen. Like hallucinating. That's it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to riff off Kyle because I think he's going to love this one. So the least surprising thing I'm going to read in the news is that we're not super intelligence yet. Like we're not even at generative intelligence yet. We're still just at narrow AI automating things because that's really what tech does and what autonomous systems do. So I think that's going to be the least surprising to me is that we are not at Terminator level AI. Kyle, to you.
It's taken me, because it's a lightning round, it's taken me a couple flashes to realize where we're going to be at. December of 2024 is going to be 1 month after the next presidential election. So I'm actually going to modify my answer real quick and say the least surprising headline that I will read is that some major inflammatory video or audio recording that has come out about some candidate was actually fake.
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's actually really close to what I was going to say. Is I was going to say some sort of AI catastrophe occurs. Which that could definitely fall in the category. I probably took the cop out of the three of us, but hey, whatever.
No, okay. I think we're hitting that mark now where like visual AI toolkits, audio AI toolkits, and video creation AI toolkits paired with the natural language is making it where we are, I think, going to be proven right by the end of this election cycle that we can't trust anything we see or read. I'm gonna go nascent.
Yep, I'm gonna add one thing in here and just say the least surprising thing also, I'm taking two shots at this, John, I apologize, is
lightning strikes twice, do it.
Yep, it could happen, right? So I think the least surprising thing we will read is that Kyle, his smooth voice is a voice skin of some other podcast host that we're gonna run it. That will be the least surprising thing to me because it's so smooth and cool.
I mean, if not for Austin, you could be not real. I'm just putting that out there.
100% true. I used to work with a warrant officer, the wonderful Will Seeley, who used to tell me that I actually don't have a voice or a personality. I'm a collection of pop culture references. And I love him forever for that. But I think that could be the case. I'm happy to be confused with an AI construct.
Kyle.ai. It's a thing.
I'm registering that right now.
Okay. Next. So we're still in December of 24. Hot tub time machine. What is the most provocative headline from the year?
Ooh, I feel like mine is also the most provocative and least surprising, but I will say the most provocative headline is that there is a growing subculture of people who are holding down like 8 jobs and just using GPT-8 to pretend to be at work and actually accomplishing things all day.
Okay, that's a pretty good one. Rich, over to you.
Yeah, I'm going to jump out of tech for a second and go into the geopolitical space. I think the most provocative thing is Danger, Will Robinson. Yeah, I think the most provocative headline is we are going to see some other revisionist power invade another country. And I think that's a horrible state of affairs. But I think if we don't get our act together as a global community, that could become a norm and we should do everything we possibly can to stop that from happening. Sorry to be a Debbie Downer on a holiday cast, but that could be the most provocative thing if we don't get things right in the next year.
Okay. My choice is actually pretty close to what Rich said, but on the tech side, one of the major US tech providers will be compromised internally by a foreign nation, not through hacking, either through purchase or da-da-da-da-da. And we're going to find out one of our major providers is not playing for the home team.
Do you want us to tell you which provider it's going to be?
No, I do not. No.
I will take a private side bet with each of you on who it's going to be.
Okay. Yeah. Not while we're recording. Thank you. Okay.
So John doesn't like to live dangerously.
Yes. I don't like angry emails is what I don't like. Yeah, that's okay. Right. So we are out of the lightning round. We have somewhat survived.
I'm tired.
Kyle. Did this year go how you thought it was going to go? Like Kyle expectations 365 ago, give or take. Is this pretty much kind of where you thought we'd be right now? Or are you a little bit surprised by some stuff?
John, before Kyle answers this question, are we talking personally? Are we talking globally? Yeah. Like scope us just a bit.
I'm talking about in technology, okay. In technology, what you read in the news, what you personally experienced. Did this year go how you thought it was going to go? Or did it kind of take a turn?
All right, so I want to validate something with the both of you guys really quick. And Rich, you may need to keep me honest here for a second. I feel like OpenAI launched the first public available version of ChatGPT in like September of last year, and it kind of like hit the hype cycle in November. So we're at like T minus 12, 13 months from people starting to freak out about AI. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you're accurate, Cal. I'll keep you honest there. Yep.
Okay. All right. So if you talk about the year going the way I thought it would, I think that, you know, post Ukrainian invasion and us getting into the sort of weird tech cycle that we were in at the end of last year, I think I've been pleasantly surprised by this year. I think that I've been very excited about technology this year. I've gotten to play with some incredible new tools. The rate of technological advancement that I feel like is happening in tech right now is unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, I've gone through the VM revolution and the cloud revolution, the container revolution and all that kind of stuff. And this is totally awesome. Like I cannot keep up and it like hurts my soul a little bit to say that out loud and admit that, but there's just so much happening and I feel really privileged. I work in a place now where I am surrounded by people who are experimenting all day and helping really cutting edge customers adopt cloud technology and more advanced artificial intelligence and machine learning technology all day. And I just feel super lucky and very privileged to be able to just sit next to those people on calls and in rooms and learn and have a place where I can go mess around with all these different new toolkits that are coming out and different large language models that I can play with that are helping my world and helping my life every day. I think this year has been awesome from tech.
Yeah, John, I'll jump in. I got to agree with Kyle, but from a completely different perspective. So yes, I think this year has been a phenomenal year in tech. I think we've had some massive challenges globally, right? As a human society that we really got to kind of think through that are kind of like, I'll use a phrase that I learned in an economics class this year, negative externalities that come from certain types of tech where there are just some negative things that, you know,
I'm going to need to define that.
Yeah. So like that, you know, an externality is something that, you know, if I deliver a product or a service, right, as a provider, right, negative things that I didn't think about that result from the fact that I released that product is the easiest way to say that, right? So like I think
unintended consequences.
Exactly right. And to some of the stuff you talked about, Kyle, about like, you know, ML or AI being used for like election interference and stuff like that. Like those are negative externalities or could be an example of that. So I think, but I do think outside of that stuff, this year has been amazing. And one of the things that I think it's, you know, been amazing this year is some of the really cool stuff that's happening in R&D. So not engineering yet, just to make a quick distinction for the audience, right? Like there's companies that do research and development on tech, and then there's other companies that productize that tech and make it consumable for consumers, right? And that's the engineering side of things, right? And so what I'm talking about is more on the R&D side. And, you know, John is probably bleeding into other parts of the cast, but I am super excited to see, you know, another shout out again for Mustafa Suleiman's book, The Coming Wave. But some of these new technologies, whether it's biotech, whether it's quantum computing, right? Like we've talked about AI enough, but those two things, biotech and quantum computing, holy crap, right? What people say there was an AI winter last decade, right? We're talking about like computing at the subatomic level, right? That's pretty awesome stuff. So I think this year was great from that perspective, from the R&D side. And I'm really excited to see how next year gets us to products that come from that R&D that consumers can consume.
Yeah. I can't agree with you more. In fact, it's funny that you say that. I was just having a conversation like 2 weeks ago about this where we haven't talked about quantum computing all year. I feel like AI came in and was like the attractive person at the party and no one started thinking about quantum computing anymore. But yeah, like I feel like if you're in quantum computing right now and you tell your friends you're in quantum computing, they'll be like, oh, that's so 2020 or something like that. I don't know. Excellent and prescient point because those things are still advancing like crazy. I've got a good friend who works in biotech at Google as well. We talk pretty regularly and I'm fascinated by what's going on there. And I think that that's just getting overshadowed by the hype cycle right now. But yeah, cool stuff coming.
Yeah, and I'm going to go a little bit negative. So I'm going to yes and everything because I agree with both of you. And I think Kyle's general vibe of kind of pleasant surprise is definitely something I feel. But I would not be completely honest with you if I didn't say this is the year where I lost a little bit of the hopefulness because it's just every single company and technology with massive OMG level flaws, basic database technology, auth providers, and every single thing in between, literally everything. This is the year everybody and everything got completely owned fairly publicly. While I think we take, I don't want to say a cynical view, I think we take a very realistic view of, hey, this is wickedly hard and there are going to be vulnerabilities, unintended things. It just felt like some of the left hooks hit a little harder this year.
John, that's fair. But I'll also say, buddy, if you just expect everyone is compromised and broken all the time, then you get to have a positive outlook. You know, you just always look on the bright side of security.
Okay. That'll work, I guess. So Kyle, what's your learning plan for the year? If the listeners are on the Kyle plan, what should they be learning or what are you planning on learning this year?
This is a great question. I always feel like this changes for me month over month, but what I will tell you that right now, and what's been kind of consistent for me since the summer, is that I want to get better at developing my own software that I can interact with. So we've talked a little bit about this in the cast, and I know John and Rich and I have all talked offline about this, but I'm really getting interested in trying to weaponize my own knowledge around like low code, no code development tools. I've been playing a lot with a lot of the low code, no code databases like Xano and Airtable and things like that, and trying to find ways where I can very quickly and by myself develop like rapid prototypes of things that interact with other things. So again, I'm just like scratching surfaces here, everybody. And if any of the listeners have any sort of recommendations for me, please hit us up on X. I can't say Twitter anymore. Hit us up on X and give us a cool learning plan because I'd love to go through it. But, you know, like I want to make an MVP of something that has a front end that I can program myself, that has a back end that I can program myself, that has a database that I can just on demand fire up and pay a very trivial amount, that I can automate API interactions with something like Zapier or Make.com. Those are the types of interactions that I want to be able to have where I just want a collection of API inputs with a front end that's real WYSIWYG that has the back end kind of built in for basic CRUD analysis and basic computation. And I realize I'm maybe describing this panacea that doesn't exist in the world. And I think that's kind of what everyone's been trying to solve for decades. But I just love seeing the stuff that's coming out. I just started messing around with Google Colab last night, which if no one's done that before and you've ever used a Jupyter notebook, it's hot fire. And you don't have to fire anything up. Like there's no infrastructure to run. You just put your thing in a Google Doc, literally in your Google Drive, and you can run a Jupyter notebook that runs anything. It's pretty cool. So that's actually like over the holiday break, what I'm going to be playing with is I'm going to try and build a for just my own, just to see if I can do it, like a basic budgeting application using low code, no code stuff that interacts with a Jupyter notebook.
Love it. Rich, over to you.
Yeah, John. So my learning plan is kind of related to a little stuff we talked about earlier on the quantum side. So right now I'm listening to a ton of podcasts, just getting the fundamentals down of, like, you know, quantum mechanics, like stuff that I read in high school. My physics teacher was like, you guys should really know this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, subatomic things. Why do I need to know that? Right. I'm a practical guy, right? I don't need the theoretical. Right. But no, on a serious note, I've been listening a ton because my interests lie at the intersection of machine learning and quantum computing and when we're going to use one instead of the other, or how we're going to pair them together. Because I don't think it's going to be an either or. To Kyle's point, like, a lot of people think that there's a panacea. I think that we're going to need awesome semiconductors that do machine learning and AI. And then there are going to be data sets that we want to crunch really fast because time is a limfac. And we're potentially going to want to use some quantum computing to do that, should that materialize into consumer products, right? You know, things like Amazon Offers, right? Bracket, their Bracket service, right, is their quantum computing service. So I'm really interested to see where this goes. And the reason I am is I just think it's an awesome race to the middle, middle being the subatomic, like, realm, where you have semiconductors getting smaller and smaller and smaller from a transistor perspective, to the point where they're probably going to have to go subatomic. And then you have people starting at the subatomic with the quantum computing piece. So anyhow, probably nerded out a ton there, but their application to defense in an ethical way, I think, is non-trivial. But if you don't understand the tech to our whole podcast, right, at least a little bit, and have the vocabulary to speak it, then I think it becomes really hard to talk to technologists or scientists that are doing this work.
All right, so we got Neil deGrasse Vaccarello giving us the hotness. I love that.
Hey, anytime somebody compares me to Neil deGrasse,
That's high praise.
About that, my friend.
Yeah, so I'm going to riff a little bit on what both of you did. So I have not had my hands in the offensive tools enough lately. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend a little bit more time working through the offensive side of things, spend a little bit of time in Cali, but I'm going to make a conscious effort. I tried to do this stuff kind of, with the book, or kind of really bare bones and just doing it all myself. I'm going to make a conscious effort to say, I don't care, and use AI to help me kind of speed through all of that stuff. I haven't tried that yet, so I'm going to give that a go and see how that helps.
Cool.
All right. And then the final question, what are you thankful for this year? And let's try to, you know, to kind of bound this a little bit inside of the podcast / technology ecosphere. What are you thankful for that happened this year?
This is great. And I hope that at this point we can bring in some sort of, like, holiday background music so we can all pretend we're sitting around the cozy fire and, you know, it's like countdown to midnight on January 30 or December 31st. But, I have a couple things. I've tried to be significantly more grateful in my life over the past few years. I think that has a net positive output and a net positive outcome for everybody that I interact with, and me especially. Like, you know, controlling the 6 inches between my 2 ears is very important, and gratitude is a good way to do that. So I'm going to start with a couple things. I am grateful for my two co-hosts, first and foremost. These guys put so much time and effort into prepping for this podcast, and I cannot stress how little they rely on me to put in that time and effort other than showing up and being kind of a wise ass. And I appreciate both of you guys so much, and for your continued service to our country and all the cool things that it is. And for those of you that don't know, we've even convinced Rich to start CrossFitting at this point. So he's now a mayhem athlete, and I'm very grateful for that as well. And I'll also turn it a little bit back into the community as well. I'm super thankful for the open source community, because there are so many incredible humans who are out there just doing amazing things and giving it away for free because for the good of the community. And it helps me so much. Thank you to everybody who's ever written a Medium article. Thank you to everybody who's ever written a LinkedIn post about technology. And just thanks to our listeners, and thanks to everyone who's listening to this, who's in the military, in the Marine Corps, doing what you do to help keep everybody safe and doing what you do to keep the tip of the spear strong. So that's my gratefulness for this year.
Yeah, John, I'll jump in here. I think the number one thing that I'm grateful for is that when it comes to technology and learning, I've really got to be honest, like, I'm just really happy that podcasts and podcasting despite the nastiness that was COVID, that podcasting wasn't a COVID hangover, right? It literally is a thing people use now to exchange ideas and actually talk about prescient problems, right? So I'm like, I love the fact, you know, Kyle, to your point, like I love doing podcasts with you guys. I love consuming podcasts, right? You know, to the point where I'm like recommending them to family members so that we can have like meaningful conversations. So I'm really happy that, you know, out of COVID, people still found a way to virtually connect with each other and exchange ideas, because I think that's what, you know, America is all about. And to Kyle's point, you know, me and John happen to be going to the same university, different colleges right now. And I can tell you, you know, if you're a listener to the podcast and you're an enlisted service member, thank you. I can't thank you enough for like deciding that you wanted to join the service and defend the country because you believe in kind of what we stand for here in the States. So I just want to say thanks to all you that are doing that, because I know it's not easy thing to do. And then also to all the government civilians that are out there doing amazing things as well, and the government technologists that are civilians. You know, a lot of times folks kind of look at the military and they're like, yeah, we can understand why people do that. I also just want to say, like, we can't do it without our government civilians as well. And the same thing with the contractors. Like, and the last thing I'll say is, you know, I guess because I had some time working with technologists at a private company, there are some private sector partners that are doing amazing things, and to name them all right now would leave people out. So I just want to say, you know, earlier I mentioned public-private partnerships, and that was literally a shout out to all of you, and you know who you are for what you do to help defend the nation. Because I think this is a whole of a nation effort that we have going on here. So yeah, love exchanging ideas on podcasts, and love the fact that people volunteer to exchange ideas and help each other be safe.
Yeah. And I'll say for my part, one, I love talking to the two of you every other week. That is amazing and super enriching. I find it super awesome that I am in a master's degree program on cyber, and the podcast has come up either indirectly of we're covering material that also gets introduced in a master's course, or we are directly referenced, a really cool thing. And the people that we get to interact with, the guests that we've had on, I went back through the list. I already felt thankful for the people that we had. And I got to kind of remember going back through, we've just had an amazing list of guests that really put out some really cool information and got us to think. And not only got us to think, got us to get approached by really neat people who either were like, I do not agree with these things that you are talking about, or that were like, hey, the way that you put this information out was really interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that. Those interactions, those people that we kind of have our lives enriched with, that has been super fun and interesting for us. And I'm super thankful. And it is that time. Kyle, hit us. I wonder, can you hit us with a hotter take than the, I think, 5 minutes straight hot take that you already came out with? Or
I don't want to try and one up myself. And so my hot take is going to be, it's been a good year. And I hope it's been a good year for all of our listeners as well. So keep learning things, keep supporting each other, keep trying to make this little blue marble a little bit of a better place. And I hope that 2024 is better for everyone. Throw on a little bit of Macklemore's next year and rock out into the new year.
And Rich, it's the holiday cast. There's family around. Be careful with those knife hands, but give it to us.
So I will just say there's only one knife hand, and I don't know that it's a knife hand. It's just a quote. And it's from a little movie called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And all I will say is be excellent to each other. So I got.
It's really good. Wild Stallions for life.
That's great. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review. We could use a couple more. Thanks for doing the ones you did, and accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.